This is the 50th episode of the IDRA Class Notes Podcast.
When you start with a premise that they don't deserve more because they're poor,
right,
and why should we waste our time and resources on them because they're not going to be any better than who they are, what hope does a child have?
There's no hope.
What dreams can a parent be really share with their child if a whole system is set up to say, you don't deserve any more than this? It is the basis for discrimination, because you then begin to say that some people by their very nature are privileged and deserve more, and others by their very nature, in this case, their poverty, deserve less. Welcome to IDRA's Class Note Podcast. I'm Dr. Bradley Scott.
I'm Aurelia Montemayor. In this podcast series, we explore issues facing education today and strategies for teachers and administrators to better serve all students. We'd love to hear your comments about this show. There'll be details at the end of this podcast on how to contact us. If you like our show, please tell three others or leave a review for us on iTunes. That helps others find us. We've set up an email alert to let you know when a new episode of Class Notes is available. If you're not subscribing to this podcast, our email alerts can help you stay up to date. Just go to our website to sign up, www.idra.org. Don't forget to sign up for our free monthly Graduation for All electronic newsletter. Again, you can sign up at our website.
By the way, Aurelio, let me just stop for a moment and thank everybody. I want to make people aware that this is our 50th episode of our Class Note podcast, and I did just want to stop and take a moment to thank all of you as our listeners for your support and for telling others about this show. Remember, it's very important that you reach and listen to our podcast through iTunes. And by the way, we would love to have you give us some feedback and rate the episodes that you listen to. Class Notes has had more than 26,000 downloads, and we are absolutely delighted by that and really hope that we can get a lot more. And our listenership has continued to grow, and we are truly grateful for that. We want to thank you for what you've done to make that happen, and I ask you to continue to support us and to get others to support listening to our podcast series. Our topic for today is really a conversation between Aurelio and me. It's under a title that we have given it called Busting Myths About Children of Poverty. And I think we have a lot to say. Aurelio, why don't you get us started with some of the things that we've been thinking about and talking about?
Well, we come from a premise and an experience that children, all children, have a lot to give, a lot to learn, and their families also are rich in information, lore, tradition. And regardless of what their economic condition is, we value them, and it's not based on romanticizing who they are. We're really concerned, though, because there are people who write books, who train teachers and train administrators, who have a very different point of view. And it bothers me and bothers all of us because, number one, when you train teachers and you help them find a shortcut that it really is not a shortcut to work with kids, it's bad. Let me just give you some of the things that, according to some people, are behaviors related to poverty. They say, children laugh when disciplined as a way to save face in a matriarchal poverty. They argue loudly with the teacher. And there's other things, but the ones that really bother me is they cannot follow directions because little procedural memory is used in poverty and sequence is not used or valued. They're extremely disorganized because planning, scheduling, or prioritizing skills are not taught in poverty. And it goes on and on. They cheat or steal because of weak support systems, weak role models, and emotional resources. It's like they talk incessantly because poverty is very participatory. Well, children, you know, I mean, it just goes on. And Bradley,
absolutely.
Your perspective, how do you react to when they come out with that list of what poor children are like?
Well, there are several things that come to my mind and have for years, one of which is that there are people who approach poverty as if it is a condition rather than just a state that people are found in. And so it almost makes it seem as if poverty has some kind of a genetic component to it. That makes me really nervous in educational settings because it becomes an easy way that people then can excuse what they are failing to do to properly serve children of poverty. So, you know, I've talked about the goals of educational equity for years, and I'm concerned that if people have a mindset that there's something deficit or wrong with these kids who come out of poverty, and that they are almost genetically predisposed
mm-hmm. yes.
not to be good performers,
right.
then it becomes an easy way then to say, well, so what do you expect me to do as a teacher or as an administrator to
it's
provide
hopeless.
A wholesome, supportive educational mm-hmm. experience for kids who are just victims of who they are? That's one way of looking at it. The other thing that bothers me is that it also, in terms of these people who have this savior mentality, I need to save these kids from the wretchedness of their existence. And so in a very paternalistic kind of way, they don't acknowledge, won't even accept any assets that kids mm-hmm. and their families bring with them to the educational experiences in schools. And so they see them as being entirely depleted of anything that they could provide in the way of contribution to their own educational experience. And so it becomes saving them from themselves. And that kind of savior mentality, I think, has done a disservice to millions of kids of poverty in our public school system. It has also, I think, done a disservice to the teachers we train, because the training context for those teachers then is you need to find ways of saving these kids and families from the wretchedness mm-hmm. of themselves. And I think that is savage, I think it's brutal, and I think it's entirely inappropriate in a public educational experience or setting that wants to really serve children and families.
I agree. I also think it's very impractical. It doesn't get the job done. When you see children as having those limitations, they will never be prepared for college. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But, you know, one of the things that you direct an equity assistance center that works in 5 states. You're one of the national leaders in that work. You've been doing it for a good while. I direct a parent information resource center working with parents. And what is said about the children comes from how they judge the family. Historically, we know, for example, that people that have our point of view, Louise Moll, the people that did Foxfire with poor whites in Appalachia, when you look at these families and these children with a balanced or an appropriate way, you find that there are riches, there is curriculum,
absolutely.
There is connections,
absolutely.
There is a lot of teachability, and you learn from them. You, in fact, what their life experience is can become the substance that you teach from to read, write, learn math, and all those other things. So it's impractical. You'll never be able to get these kids prepared for college if you come from this premise. And we're talking about large numbers of kids.
Absolutely. And the work that we do in the Equity Assistance Center, we come up a lot of times against mindsets that first of all say that there are things that are not even appropriate for this population. I tell the story because it's a real incident. In one of our Texan schools, working with a staff of middle school teachers, almost to a person, whose notion about the kids was that they were going to be like their mothers and fathers, most of whom would end up dropping out of school, working in fields as laborers, not aspiring to go to college. So therefore, out of this impoverished condition and state that they're in, why should we even think about giving them algebra and calculus? They need just basic math. They need basic literacy. They don't deserve more. And so it becomes almost as if one is going to affix that because they are poor, they don't deserve mm-hmm. anything more than what poverty might produce. When you start, in my mind, Aurelio, with a premise that they don't deserve more because they're poor.
Right.
And why should we waste our time and resources on them because they're not going to be any better than who they are? What hope does a child have?
There's no hope.
What dreams can a parent be really share with their mm-hmm. child if a whole system is set up to say, you don't deserve any more than this? And then you give them the leftovers from the table of education and the possibilities of what their lives might become. It is a horrible place,
mm-hmm.
a horrible disadvantage to place kids in. But even more importantly, from the work that we do in the Equity Assistance Center, it is the basis for discrimination, because you then begin to say that some people by their very nature are privileged and deserve more, and others by their very nature, in this case, their poverty, deserve less. And you begin to treat them differently. You have different notions about inclusion. You also have different notions about who deserves a real opportunity to
right.
learn. Upon whom should we use our resources? And what does our accountability look like with regards
right.
to them?
You're tracking them early on.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the programs that IDRA developed almost close to 30 years ago now Coca-Cola Valley Youth Program, its premises are valuing the students. So every year we have Leadership Day for them. They get together. These are teenagers, middle school and high school students that are tutoring little ones. And it's all premised on the fact that they can be tutors.
Absolutely.
A couple of years ago in a Texas city, our director was preparing the teachers to have a Leadership Day, and they were going to bring in some colleges to talk to them about college and stuff like that. And some of the teachers in the very program were saying, they're not college material, you're raising false hopes. And our shock was, here is a program where we're nurturing this, and we still haven't been able to reach those faculty members deeply enough to say, these teenagers are college material. And so every time we go to a large audience and we're talking about college preparation for the kids we're concerned about, the first thing we hear is, but college is not for everybody. You know, college is not
right,
for everybody.
Right, absolutely.
Right away. And it's just like, Now, I want you to compare, because you've got a set of very powerful equity principles. In our parent work, we develop a set of principles that are the premises we operate from.
I'm glad you're going to talk about these. They're important. Absolutely.
Yeah. So we say families can be their children's strongest advocates. Families of different race, ethnicity, language, and class are equally valuable. Families care about their children's education and are to be treated with respect, dignity, and value. Within families, many individuals play a role in their children's education. And those are just a few. And what I want you to do is, what are the equity principles that you operate out of?
And there are six for us. So the first one is that among different populations, diverse populations, you should see comparably high achievement outcomes and other student outcomes. There's the goal of equitable inclusion, access and inclusion. So no matter how a child comes to us, they should have equitable access to high-quality programs, good teaching, educational experiences, irrespective of the differences. The third goal is equitable treatment, that to get a child into an educational experience and then treat them and their families with disrespect, disregard, of course, they are going to not perform well because the system then is set up to do that. So equitable treatment is that third. For me, I think a powerful driver is the fourth goal, which is equitable opportunity to learn. Not equal opportunity, but an equitable opportunity to learn. First of all, accepting and acknowledging the aspects of the diversity a child brings with him or her into the educational setting, then the system is obligated to be responsive to that in a way. Not to say that all children are alike and all children are the same and that they all learn the same, but that they come to us out of different experiences and in different ways. And we have to find ways to respond to those differences so that they have a fair chance to reach the high standards that all students are being held to. The next goal speaks to an equitable distribution of resources. It's not about who is privileged to have a good education. Yes. It's about every child in a public educational setting has a right to a fine education. If it's been given to any child in that educational setting, then every child has to be afforded that same right. And then the final goal for me, Aurelio, as we do our equity work, is this notion of equitable shared accountability, that everybody is responsible for ensuring that all kids have a rich educational experience. And for me, in a connection with what you were saying about families, they have a right to have a voice, to have that voice included and responded to. They have a right to make decisions and be a part of the decision-making strategy of a district. They have a right to hold themselves and other stakeholders accountable for ensuring that every child has a fair and equitable opportunity to learn. And they also have a right for redress when they are being wronged. They have a right to say, you are not being fair, you're not doing right by my child, and I want it changed. They have a right for due process under the law to make sure their kids are not being placed at a disadvantage because they happen to be poor. You know, it's ridiculous. And until we are willing to step up to that, and even in our teacher training and preparation, to help educators, to help administrators understand that they have a ongoing responsibility to ensure that what they do with and for children and in support of children in school, it must be fair and equitable. We're missing the mark if we are failing to make sure that they leave with the right kind of mindset about valuing. I love that principle of valuing you talked about in the Coca-Cola Value Youth Program.
We were talking right before we started typing is that there might be a lot of very fair-minded educators who want to do best, but they also might want a quick shortcut or an easy answer.
Absolutely.
And one of the things, for example, our organization was founded over 35 years ago just on the basis that how schools are funded in Texas is inequitable. You have the rich schools and the poor schools. And 10% of the wealthiest school districts with 10% of the children say, we have the properties, the property tax base. And when we started this battle and we were getting the decision makers in our state capital to change, they quickly labeled what we want to do, the Robin Hood plan, as if they're poor taking from the rich.
Robin from the rich.
We are all accountable. You know, like your last principle, we are all accountable for all our children. So that's important that we're all accountable. And money does make a difference. But on the other hand, all the money and resources in the world, if teachers do not see it from our perspective, you know, you've got you're going to have a beautiful cage. It's a gold cage, limiting these children from going to college, from being seen as being able to handle advanced science,
advanced math, and stuff.
It's like the old sexist notions that girls aren't somehow built to understand math and science. Well, we hope that went by the wayside, although there's still, you know, I think there's still some dilemmas there. But if children come from a family that doesn't speak the language, are economically disadvantaged, or are recent immigrants, we have no reason, from our point of view, to have these negative assumptions, limiting assumptions. I was looking at the list of what they say is they're disrespectful to the teacher. Well, middle class and rich kids can be disrespectful. You know,
you have
kids who have resources right now that are being very disrespectful because you tell them you cannot have your phone, you cannot be text messaging in class. This is across the board. Teenagers are teenagers. How can we ascribe bad behavior to one group and good to the other?
And it's not a characteristic of poverty alone or exclusively. And all of these training programs operating around this country that school districts are buying, spending thousands of dollars on, that come out of these stereotypical views of children of poverty, families of poverty, and then give a pill. Here's the pill you need for this kind of a child or this kind of
and
a family.
And all the heads are nodding in the audience.
Right. And these are, in many instances, well-meaning heads, people who are not maliciously out to destroy kids, but who feed on that fodder as if, in fact, this is the magic bullet to work with these kids. And I'm saying, you know, we need to teach people to have a critical ear and a critical disposition about those kinds of ways of grouping and characterizing populations of kids and families in public schools, to say, wait a minute, let's stop and look at that. Do you mean to tell me that that is true for all kids, that all poor kids are disrespectful to teachers because that's their nature? Or is there something wrong with that premise that you're starting from about those kids?
Imagine if we would say all white teachers are racist.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
We would never say that.
Exactly. Nor would we condone it.
No.
When we heard
it.
No. Exactly.
And so why would we say anything about all poor kids or all any group of kids? It's just, I can't remember, there's a term in sociology, they call it, you're making them into an object that they're not.
Right,
they're creating
right.
You, just not at all.
And also a part of that is how people easily begin to conflate being poor with minority. It becomes almost a synonym for it then, you know. So I'm not going to say the M word, minority. I'll say the P word, but I really mean that.
Yes, I mean the other.
And so it becomes fixed to them once again as if one is the other. You know, we need to help teachers and administrators unbundle those notions, find out what about them are, those notions are classist and racist and sexist, etc., so that they can use a real discriminating eye about how we really create programs and classroom instruction and pedagogy that is appropriate for kids who are different, and not try to make it quick fix and easy answers for what it takes to move this child to excellence.
You know, both you and I have been classroom teachers, and you and I have experienced great success with kids who come from
these very populations.
And it brings me back because they might say, well, I'm Latino and you're African-American, so you're biased. I said, well, go back to Al Capp and how he treated poor whites in Appalachia. That was clearly a class notion that little Abner and all those families were dumb. There were adults that were childlike. They were stupid. So you have some educators go into those same mountains and they discover grandma can make a zither and they have these rich traditions that created stuff. And all you have to do is stop looking those children as if they're, you know, we tag them by geography. We have at-risk campuses. Teachers will say, oh, you don't want to go to that campus.
Absolutely.
You know, so you're already limiting yourself by part of town, all these other things. College recruiters don't come to certain high schools because they know even their best aren't good enough for us. You know, you have all these constrictions. Well, we don't have those.
Absolutely.
We know that at any one of these schools, you're going to find an Einstein, you're going to find the next Frida Kahlo, you're going to find whatever, you know, they're going to be there.
You mentioned something, and it really resonated with me, talking about a gold cage, you know?
Yeah.
I'm going to give you, what are you complaining about? Your cage is gold, but it's still a cage. It limits you. It's a very powerful notion, Aurelio. You don't mind if I steal that, do you?
Please go with it.
Because that's an important concept. This notion that because you are who you are, a child of who has lived in poverty, that doesn't define who you are.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't explain who you are. You know, it speaks to a condition in which you live, but it does not define who you are as a person and what your capacities are. So nor should teachers, nor should other educators, principals, other administrators begin to think that because you came out of poverty, mm-hmm. that you can or cannot be whatever it is you might, you and your family might dream for you to be. I think we have to look at that. You know, I'm looking at our time. Any
closing
comments?
Well, I just want to go back. Your equitable access. I was just thinking, you know, both you and I have done work with teenagers and computers and how they help bridge it to families.
Mm-hmm.
If a child does not have a computer at home, of course I want the computer access in school.
Yeah.
But that says nothing about the family or the child.
Exactly.
It's just, we'll have the computer there. That's it.
That's right.
That's good.
Listen, I think we could talk for another 4 hours about this, but I know our time is running out.
Yeah.
I was hoping, as you and I just had this conversation, we could get our listeners to think about some different ways of looking at poverty and kids and families that live in poverty and how we appropriately respond, but not in stereotypical and patronizing and deprecating ways, but in supportive ways to move kids to excellence, which is their comparable right with kids who may come from middle class experiences, and also support and value the families from which they come. That's hugely important. I think that if we have done that in terms of whetting the minds of our listeners, I think we've done a good job. It has been such a great pleasure to sit with you Aurelio, our 50th episode of a podcast. And I do want to remind our listeners that we sure would like to hear from you. Please not only listen to our show, but tell two or three other folks about our show. Ask them to go to iTunes, listen, and be sure to leave a response. We certainly appreciate that. And don't forget, we will be sending out email alerts to let you know about our new podcast. We invite you to listen or visit our Graduation for All website and see the wonderful things that we are up to. Don't forget to sign up, by the way, for our free monthly Graduation for All electronic newsletter. Again, as we are closing out, we thank you for your continued listenership and your support. Please tell others, and we'll see you the next time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to IDRA Class Notes. For more information on IDRA and other Class Notes topics, go to www.idra.org. You can also send us your thoughts by email to podcast@idra.org or fill out the form on our podcast webpage at www.idra.org/podcasts.